Faith Strong Today presents WikiGod with Mark Grollo. Hear new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe to the podcast at faithstrongtoday.com.
Well, hey, friends, welcome to WikiGod, our stories shaping God in Toronto. And this is the Faith Strong Today edition of the show. I'm your host, Mark Grollo. And I am pounding the pavement throughout Toronto, dragging around my recording equipment, and I'm sitting down and wikiing God with authors and artists and ministers and academics and nonprofit people, all kinds of different people, wherever they can sit down long enough to talk to me, and I'm hearing their story, what they think, and we are getting a picture of why they do what they do, and a picture of God as well. So this week, we are wikiing God with Alice Vandervennen. She is an accomplished artist. She focuses on using found objects to create art. She's an art teacher. She conducts art workshops around the GTA. You can check out everything she's about at alicevandervennen.ca. And in fact, you may even want to head over there right now as this conversation gets underway so you can visualize her work along with us and as our discussion about what she does unfolds. I caught up with Alice at a community center where her artwork was to be displayed. It's a great conversation. You know, artists are so important to the church and to our world, and they get us to think and to feel, and I think to access parts of ourselves in ways that nobody else can. So Alice does that. She's a part of the community. It's a pleasure to talk to artists. So let's get right to it. Strap in and let's wiki some God now with Alice Vandervennen. One interesting thing that I came across when I was reading about you and snooping around about you on the internet was that you like to put music on while you work in your studio. Mm-hmm. So what music do you like to listen to in your studio? And would we be surprised by your choice? Like, you know, what is it, the stereotypical, oh, I listen to classical Mozart? Or
no.
Is it like hip-hop or something like that?
Well, it's not that varied, but it does change a bit according to the day. Like at 5 o'clock in the morning, I love listening to Gregorian chant.
Nice.
It's very meditative and it's very quiet. And you know, the world is still dark, so I can just kind of be quiet in my studio.
Wow, 5 in the morning.
Yeah, if there's a show coming. I love listening to Leonard Cohen as well, and probably because one of a line or two that he has, I mean, he's got many lines that are very important, but it's so meaningful to me, and that is that one song where he says, "There is a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in." And you know, especially in my work, I mean, when things don't go right, somehow it somehow makes the piece better in an odd way. Like, you know, I put two colors together and it doesn't work, but then if I add another color, it becomes a layered and a much richer effect. So just knowing that when things don't work out, you know, when there is that crack, that proverbial crack in it, it becomes stronger, it becomes richer. And
so that's the song you reach for when things aren't quite going well. You put that one on.
Yeah, and also that the one song that the quote-unquote the Amazing Whip Sisters sing on one of his albums. And if it be your will, let my voice be still on this broken hill, if it be your will. And, you know, so much of working, so much of doing art is like a prayer. And, you know, it's an offering up, you know, the work of my hands, like blessing the work of my hands. And you know, I feel incredibly blessed to be able to do this kind of work. But it does feel like if it is God's will, you know?
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Do you find that your art might change depending on what music you're playing? I mean, I know back when I was seminary writing an essay or something, if I had movie theme music on, my mm-hmm. essay would take on a very melodramatic tone, yeah. my writing. But, or, you know, if I was playing U2 or something, it's kind of, oh, my essay is in a good mood.
Yeah.
Does,
yeah.
that, does it
I
affect
haven't
you?
I found that too okay. much. I, you know, going back to working at 5 o'clock in the morning, my work changes when the sun comes up because the light is so different. You know, suddenly the studio is filled with natural sunlight and it's just, it just changes everything,
right.
Including the piece.
Yeah.
So
maybe talking about your studio a little bit, can mm-hmm. you take us through virtually if we were to meet you at your studio and you let us in there, what would we see? What are we seeing?
Well, it would have to be virtual because
yeah.
my studio is a bit of, well, it's not a danger zone, but it's literally, you'd be walking on pins and needles and...
which are on the floor?
On the floor, as is a lot of things. It's like, you know, I work visually and not like logically, so I need to see the materials that I'm working with, and so I'm literally taking these baskets of bits and scraps and all those kind of fabrics, and I'm dumping them. I'm literally like dumping, rooting them, putting them together with other things. I've had people try to clean my studio, and that, you know, I was like, no, thank you, you know. So,
but I read somewhere that a co-op student did get in there,
and
you haven't quite recovered.
No, I haven't. Like, she wanted to put all the colors together. So a yellow I never in my life will ever use is mixed in with my precious yellow that I use all the time, you know. And so
well, it sounds like you wouldn't organize by color. You would organize by feel or type of fabric.
Or
there's
more
different ways to categorize.
Oh yeah.
And this student did color, but it sounds like you would do age or texture
or something I've just been working on.
Hmm.
I think it's more categorized according to, I've just been working on this. There is a piece here in this pile of fabric and or a textile, and it's worth saving together. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're walking on pins and needles.
Yeah, you're walking on pins and
needles. Our feet are bleeding, but what are we seeing? What else are we seeing?
You are seeing, it's like I'm quilting. You know, nothing that one might typically think of this as a quilt. Like I'm quilting like copper and sticks and stones and nails and textiles, of course. So, you know, it's not something you want to put on a guest bed, guest room bed or anything, depending on your guests, I guess. But it truly is like a three-dimensional quilt. Like, it's like an assemblage.
Huh.
And you'll see my sewing machine that knows how to sew through copper.
Nice.
And
I did notice when I saw your pieces, those fine little holes in the copper sheets.
Yeah.
How do you get those? Is it like a sewing machine for copper?
Sewing machine.
Wow.
Yeah. And you'll notice lots of wire, because I love wrapping sticks with wire and all that. So, yeah.
Hmm. Is it a separate room or a separate building adjacent to the house?
No, it is in my house, and it's got a beautiful south window, you know, on eye level with the big maple tree and birds and all that. And it's actually through bedrooms, so people often say, well, I'll come to your studio. And I'm like, no. You know. But now that my youngest, she's 21 and she's in Guelph University, now that my children have, you know, pretty much moved out, they I'm also taking over their bedrooms as studio space.
Okay.
So, you know, as my children grow, my pieces grow. So...
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe we can leap back. That's where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that I kind of read about you and even her, some of your interviews online. Mm-hmm. 1980 is this kind of yeah. magical year that keeps coming up. 1980 is generally marked as kind of the beginning yeah. of your career. So, again, if we could eavesdrop on that year, time yeah. travel, and see what's going on in your life, what's yeah. going on in 1980 for you?
Well, I graduated from university, and I started my first job of teaching art at Durham Christian High School, and that's in Bowmanville, Ontario. Hmm. And so that was a wonderful kind of interaction of art and teaching and that. And I've always taught part-time, and so I've always been able to maintain a studio. And so that was like the first time I worked in a studio, my own studio, and so it just kind of progressed from there.
You started yeah. with sculpture?
Was that yeah, I did a lot of clay.
Early 80s?
Yeah, I did a lot of clay sculpture, and I also did a lot of tapestry weaving. But both those, I still use bits of what I did back then in my work, but my work has really changed from that, yeah.
Okay. What prompted that change? Just your evolution as an artist? Or?
Yeah, well, part of it is circumstance, and that is, you know, there's a lot of technical elements to doing clay sculpture, and there's a lot of technical elements to doing tapestry weaving. And, you know, you need time, space, money for that. And there was a time that wasn't so available for me. So I pretty literally reached for what was available, and that was textiles. And so I was still kind of sculpturing, but sculpturing with, you know, things that were easy attainable, like textiles, like buttons, like stones, okay. like little bits of found objects. Yeah.
So you can't work with giant steel beams
no.
anymore.
In fact, my studio. Yeah, I found at one point my studio was literally my placemat. You know, the spot on the kitchen table. You know, so and my work was small, and it worked. You know.
Well, that's hugely inspiring, isn't it? Just the ability to. I mean, the way you still have a successful career and can do what you love, but learned how to kind of channel through the changes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, it's exciting to do that. Yeah. Yeah.
A word that comes up a lot, when you talk about your art is mm-hmm. the word playful.
Mm-hmm.
Why does play figure so largely in kind of how you describe your work and your process? It's one of your favorite words, it seems, when you're describing this stuff.
That's interesting. I haven't thought of it that way. I taught kindergarten. I taught high school for 13 years, and I taught kindergarten art for 17 years. And, you know, there's just such a joy working with children, but also seeing the joy in children. And I might use play in terms of it's... Like, for me, creating art is not so much a logical process. Mm. It's like putting this with that and seeing how those pieces go. And sometimes I feel like I'm doing a big puzzle. Or maybe it's like directing an orchestra or a choir, you know, wanting to see more, wanting to hear more, you know, quieting up that red in that one corner, having the yellow come speak out a bit more, you know, that kind of thing. And so I'm constantly, you know, putting one thing here, another thing there. And when I watch a child at play, I think, oh, looks like they're doing what I do. So either they're working or I'm playing, right. You know. Yeah.
So do you feel like maybe children are somehow more closely connected to that instinct? That maybe something about our culture or the way we're, the environment we grew up in kind of muffles that a little bit? Like the logic-driven... kids seem to be able to do it instinctively.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I feel pretty passionate about children and about children and art and, you know, allowing children to do art and, you know, putting away those crayon, those coloring books for a while. Anyway, it's not like they do, you know, bad damage, but, you know, really, come on. Like, children love painting. Let them paint, you know. Let them explore. And I have been so astounded with what children do, both the high school child, but also the very young child, like the three-year-old, the four-year-old. And I've been blown away by that. Hmm. Yeah.
Psychologically, for a child, what do you think is the importance of a child doing art and having access to paint and things like that? Because you're somewhat of an advocate, I think, for children doing art, having been a teacher, but even more than that, it's close to your heart. What's the actual benefit in a child's life to have access to doing art, do you think?
I'm not sure if I could even use the word benefit. It feels like it's just part of who they are.
Okay.
And so to deny him that is to deny a very basic element of their growing up. Mm. So it's, you know, it for me, it's just like, you know, there's no agenda. A child simply needs to paint. A child simply needs to work with color. A child, you know, just delights in that. And that's that.
Yeah.
You know?
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it would be neat to show you a picture of one of your pieces.
Yeah.
And actually invite listeners. I'm going to be providing links. And if listeners are on the website, they can look at it right now along with you. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through? I've got this particular one that I chose, Totem Stone.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through this piece a little bit, maybe how it developed and what it's evoking? I know maybe an artist doesn't like to say, what I'm trying to do, or here's what you need to get from this.
Yeah.
But you remember putting this one together?
Yeah,
you're intimately connected with
it. Yeah.
So maybe as listeners can look at it and hear you talk about it, we can feel that connection. Mm-hmm.
Well, I love that whole concept of totem and that whole concept of collecting stories. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm so attracted to textile is that, you know, every piece of textile has that, I mean, it has all the elements of art, color, shape, line, texture, and all that. But it also has the history, the story, the history of its of who made it, the history of how it was made, the history of its use and, you know, where it was used and all that. Mm. And it's not that we need to know those stories or know those histories, but it's just fascinating to create something. And then when it's done, I'm like, oh my goodness, there is like cultures from around the world kind of captured in this one piece. And it just blows me away how that happens.
Mm. So it does happen as it's being created.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I always work from aesthetics. Like, oh, this red looks so amazing with that green or something like that, you know? So it's always like putting things together, adding, taking away, you know, making it speak in different ways.
Is the visual primary and then kind of those meanings are secondary in the sense of once it's finished, then you can kind of say all the things it's saying?
Yeah, exactly.
So primarily it's the visual for you. You're putting things
absolutely
together and seeing how they speak. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not that we're imposing meaning on it afterward, but we're kind of making sense of the creative process that kind of exploded on your work table.
Yeah, and it always surprises me. Mm. Like when a piece is finished, I just get a sense of wow, oh my goodness, that's so cool. And I don't even feel like I make it sometimes, you know, like so it just kind
like
of
a muse took over and
yeah, or whatever that's called. Oh. Yeah.
Specifically about this piece.
Well, this piece.
Four squares and the copper, that copper wire in the middle.
Yeah. Now, you know, I have like my basket of favorites of fabrics and that. And I remember, well, I should go back. One thing is that when you're an artist and you work with, quote unquote, the found fabric, people give you things. Hey, Alice, I got this. Or, hey, Alice, this is some fabric that I can't throw out, but I don't want to have it in my house anymore. Can you do anything with it? So
once the word gets out that you're...
Yeah.
you take
things
stuff like that.
Appear on the front porch, on the veranda, like, oh, look at that. but a friend of mine... came to, you know, one of our gatherings, and he had this huge, thick coil, copper coil, and it was from a boat cinch, you know, like winding the boat, something like he's a sailor, and he works with wood and all that. And he said, "Hey, Al, I got this. What do you think? Can you use it?" And just that. You know, just the gift of that. Like, it has just, like, you know, like, the whole effect of his... Just that simple gift of this coil just exploded into a number of pieces.
Right.
All with that copper in it. Yeah. And I still have some at home, and I'm always trying to work it in.
Did you have to clean it up?
No, it wasn't
really,
that.
It's so brilliant. And,
I know, yeah. I mean, he was excited about it, you know. Doug Jones, and he was like, "Isn't this great? Isn't this great copper?" And you know, so like he was excited about it, and he didn't want to put it in his, you know, metal recycling thing.
He wanted to go to a good home.
He wanted to see it, you know. So yeah.
Okay. Is there significance to kind of the four squares, or the fact that it's kind of vertically? I guess that's totem in the sense of totem pole, or
So I like to do the four squares, or you know, sculptural. All my work is framed in like a 3-inch shadow box frame, so there are limits that way. But I found it's been good to limit my work, because otherwise, truly, a piece could, you know, grow as large as the studio. I just keep adding and adding and adding. And so, yeah, it's good to, you know, have the boundary of, you know, this large and that. And so even when I look at that piece, you know, I see fabric that... that came, like, that's African mud cloth. I see new fabric. I see a little piece of quilt that's like 200 years old that's been worn right through and was quilted over on top. And even that was worn through. And then I purchased at a secondhand shop. And, you know, and the ladies are saying, "Well, that quilt will do really well for a pet or something." I'm like, "Yes, it will." Go home, cut it up, you know, that kind of thing. So it just all comes together. And it's exciting.
Yeah. So you talk a little bit about your interest in, well, human stories in these pieces, but women's stories in particular, through the pieces of maybe the African cloth or the quilts. Or when I hear you say women's stories about your art, I probably wouldn't have necessarily said women's stories. I would have said there's a lot of story in
there. There's a lot of stories.
What is it about your story, though, that sparked your interest in women's stories and trying to bring those stories to the surface?
Well, I used to... my work used to be, maybe in the 90s or so, it used to be far lighter, not as much a color or in that. And I used a lot of stones, and I was working with the ceramics at that point yet. And I was really reaching for that concept of gathering stories, gathering women's stories. And I think what sparked that was, you know, the women in my family, they were in Holland during World War II. And, you know, working very hard and, you know, trying to survive. And especially I think of one of my father's sister, who, you know, she's since passed away, but her name would be Aunt Jane, or we know her as Tanyankia. And, you know, she actually, she hit people, you know, at too much danger to her family. She hit people of Jewish descent so that, you know, the Nazis wouldn't get them. And, you know, it was an incredible act of bravery and all that. And yet, we never heard those stories. And there was always kind of a common understanding that we had. And it wasn't until she, you know, was in her 90s and she couldn't, like, her brain wasn't quite able to hang on to those tight secrets anymore. And, you know, and then she just started telling all those stories, but in her her dialect of Gronings, you know, so or Dutch. It's a Dutch dialect, and those stories came out, and it struck me that often we hear the stories of men and their, you know, their efforts and all that, but
so you heard the male exploits of that story, this particular one that you're talking
well,
about.
Well, yeah, we heard. I mean,
the resistance, and
yeah, we heard the, you know, those kind of stories, or but we didn't hear her. But, you know, so I didn't really have her stories until later. But I did have a lot of her handiwork, and so even though I didn't have her written story or anything, I had. Like what I would say, like the work of her hands, and so, or not maybe not all of her hands, but of women like her, and so that's what I was collecting. You know, their crochet, their knitted, their needle points, and I was using that in a visual, just to kind of create that visual story. So that's kind of where it all started, and then using stones, because stones just have that history to them as well. I mean, they're just, you know, you find stone and you have really no idea of its story, but yet it's there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I was going to ask you about that. The textile, I think because it's human made, we can say, oh, well, it obviously has a story.
Yeah.
But you speak of stones and branches also having a story, almost like you are able somehow to step outside of yourself and imagine the story of the tree and the rock that has been going on for, in a tree's case, hundreds of years, in a rock's case, thousands, millions of years. That's a story to you.
Yeah, and it's a mystery, and I don't need to know the answer, or I don't need to know the literal story, but it's fun to hear, or it's fun to understand that, you know, that this stone has been around, and that this stone has history, and that has formed it and has made it beautiful.
How have found objects become central to your work? Now, you trained in sculpture, and I think for sculptors, the found object is kind of endemic to the work, do I have that right? Is this something that you kind of chose to do because of that family history, or is that very common to a sculptor to use found objects, or is it a bit of both? Did you gravitate to sculpting because of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I love the whole concept of history. I love the concept of process as revealed in, you know, the stone, the textile. And in the same way, the process of, you know, what one sees, you know, in that found object. You know, like the rust or the tarnish, or like that all informs, but it also it's a visual thing as well. I was trained in the 80s, or sorry, in the late 70s, where the whole concept of sculpture included what something of, like, let the bolt show, like, show the process, don't hide how it's made, and so that it, like, have the process become part of the aesthetic story.
Right. And you actually add bolts right into the middle of some fabric in your work.
Yeah.
Let the bolts show and add a few.
Yeah.
Make them very, very prominent in the piece. Yeah. And so a very distinct kind of style has emerged for you. As I've become more familiar with your work, when you see an Alice van der Venen work, you you know it when you see it. So just curious, as an artist, how did this style just emerge, and does it just persist somehow, or is it now kind of something like a signature where you're working to maintain that look and feel, for lack of a better word, maybe commercial ability or marketability? Like, you don't want to make pieces that are wildly different, that there's a flavor that has emerged.
I'm not sure. I'm just so intrigued with like that whole process of what I'm doing. And every time I finish a piece, I'm so excited to do another piece. And so I find myself reaching for the same, you know, the same kind of form. I find myself I just don't feel finished with it. I'm just so intrigued with it. I can't stop looking at it.
So this is where you said if it weren't given a boundary, it would just be one gigantic piece.
It's like, okay.
So essentially it is a gigantic piece. It's just broken up into pieces, I guess.
Exactly. Okay.
Was there a part in your career? I mean, I've seen your last few years where there was kind of a break in style. If I look back to maybe the early 90s, or is there a clear sense of continuity, or did you take a turn and say, wow, this is very different than this?
Yeah, at some point I introduced color, and now it did happen a little bit gradual, but you know, a course here, a workshop there, try this, try that, and you know, I always kind of work from a gut reaction of wow. You know, like it catches me off guard. I'm excited about it. And so I think, you know, it maybe that would have happened about 10 years ago, you know. And, you know, to be fair, I should say it's also when my family, they were getting older and not quite as dependent on, you know, on me, and so I wasn't doing all the little mothering details, you know, that take up a lot of time. You know, it's all good, but so my work has changed as my family has grown, and
Is this, and I don't want to be reductionistic, is there a kind of a singular message that you would say your body of work is trying to communicate to the audience?
I don't think so.
No.
I'm just doing it. I'm just intrigued by it.
So if there is a singular message, it's being imposed.
Yeah.
And there is always that interplay between what the artist is trying to say and what the viewer is superimposing or bringing to it from their own experience. Because I feel like I've got your work completely figured out.
Oh, dear.
But again, that's because I'm approaching it from... And I realize as I'm looking at the art, it so resonates with me perfectly that I think I must be superimposing.
I don't know. Well, a close friend of my husband and I, it's an art therapist, and he goes, "Hey, Hals, when I look at your work, I'm like, Ed, stop right there." And
you don't want to know what?
No, I do not want to know. So,
are you worried about him psychoanalyzing you?
Yeah, it's okay. It's all good. But no, I'm not trying to say anything. I'm not trying to, you know, to do anything. I'm just delighted to work, and you know, and. Yeah, I'm intrigued, and I'm just working.
Okay, that's beautiful.
Maybe that's where the whole thing of play comes in. Maybe that's what play is. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, it's certainly fortunate that your version of play, we all want to see it. I mean, that works out well for you.
Okay.
That when you're playing, you know, a kindergarten class painting.
Yeah.
Doesn't have a huge audience. People aren't lining up to see kindergarten children play. They should.
They should. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
But in your case, when you go to play and then you hang it up, there's a magic there that we want to be a part of.
Oh, thank you.
maybe now just to kind of to ask a little bit about your community, people in your life, and some of the maybe ethos, your faith, things like that. How have other people in your world and in your life been instrumental in getting your art out there and in kind of helping you along with a balanced life or balance?
Well, my my husband, my my partner, Mark Mark Manorven, and he has always been absolutely amazing and has always recognized the absolute you can't negotiate need for me to have studio time. And so that has always been part of our lives. And, you know, even when the children were really small, they would, my studio time was like when they were napping or something like that. And, you know, I'd put them in the in their stroller right in my studio, and I'd put my foot on their bed, on their little stroller, and every time they woke up, I'd jiggle it again. For a while, my son couldn't sleep unless he was jiggled.
So, that takes skill. You're working with your hands on the table and your feet under the table.
Yeah. Keep sleeping. No. But, you know, and then when they were younger, I would hire a high school child or a high school girl that they just loved, and she would play with them in the backyard in the sandbox, you know, for 2 hours or so, and that would give me studio time, because I find that continuity is so important. And sometimes even on Christmas Day, I find myself running up to the studio just to try something, because if I walk away from it for even a week, it feels so hard to get back into it, like a cold car, So, and, I just love being there. So that's one thing. Like, part of the our family setting has always made room for studio time. Finding creating an artist community around us. Our friends are artists. We have what we call the arts group, and we meet once a month, and we take turns looking at each other's work and share a meal and all that. We've done that for 25 years. And then also I was part of a cooperative gallery, and that's been fantastic.
Is that the group that was part of your transition from teaching into more creating and displaying? Can you talk a little bit about that group?
Well, that there would be, we started this cooperative gallery, the Colborne Art Gallery, and what was so good about it was that every 6 weeks there would be a new show. So every 6 weeks I had to have three pieces completed. Like, not only completed, but mounted, framed, with the hardware on the back of the frame so that it can hang, and getting it totally ready. And just in doing that, my work started to sell. I started to get a body of work. My husband would always document every piece. From that comes a website. You got to put your pieces on the website, and so it's been good.
Other people kind of helping you through the tedious aspects of, I guess, like the framing, and that you say this stuff and it sounds so daunting.
Well, it is daunting at first.
And photographing it, and then getting a website.
Mean, those are all things like, it's not that they helped me through that, but they, there is that expectation, like, or they advised me to do it, do it, get it done. And then, slowly, those what seemed like a big deal, they're not big deals anymore, right? Yeah. And then, on to the next step. And then when I became part of the Eno Gallery, that enters that whole commercial element. And, they've been very instrumental in, just getting my work out there, but also you know, requiring me to, or holding me accountable to create and present work that, you know, is gallery quality, you know?
I believe your work to be profoundly theological. Maybe that's because I'm kind of a theology geek. Yeah. And again, that's super imposing. But when I first discovered your work and was looking at it and thinking about even your process, you have an artist statement kind of front and center on your website, this idea of taking, I mean, it sounds almost biblical, if not overtly, taking a found object that has been, like you said, rusted or corroded, or, and instead of just throwing it in the trash bin, reclaiming it, and not even scraping away the rust or whatever, but showcasing the experience, you could say, the what has happened to this piece, and showcasing it in a new and beautiful way, and putting it with other found objects that allow that piece to really shine, and the beauty that comes when you put those things together, and then it becomes this beautiful mosaic that makes us think and brings richness to our lives. Again, it's like a metaphor for for people. I just, do you see that? Again, is that me? Is that, is there anything about your faith that informs that? That's a total superimposed. All right, good. Well, now you know what I think of you.
I'm just doing it. I'm just doing it. You know, I'm just enjoying it. And really, like, I have to admit, I'm not thinking about what I'm doing. Like, it's,
well, then
it's,
I just should thank you for putting in a visual my theology.
No, I'm just, you know, so it's totally illogical.
So then maybe we can take something you have said, part of your artist statement. I strive to have my art celebrate the human spirit in relation to its creator, whether from secret spaces or the most flamboyant expressions. Can you kind of expound a little bit on that particular part of the quote?
Yeah. You know, I think everything that we do is, you know, kind of like to the glory of God. And you know, when I'm in my studio, I feel very near to God. And, you know, when I'm in that process of creating, I feel like sometimes I'm having a conversation with God, you know, like it's like I feel the blessing or his smile or her smile. And part of it is, yes, people say, oh, you know, you have that gift. And I'm thinking, yeah, and a gift is to be enjoyed, you know. I don't, I'm not on a mission with with my work. You know, I'm just simply doing it and feeling incredibly thankful that I can enjoy this, you know, and I can just celebrate color, and I can just celebrate all these different things put together, and you know, it's all part of creation. Yeah.
How do you primarily conceptualize God? You know, kind of word association. When I say God, how do you conceptualize God in your mind? I think that, you know, every single person will have a different answer to that. Even if they believe the same doctrine or dogma or sitting in the same pews on Sunday.
Yeah.
Everyone will have a different idea of God primarily. Mm-hmm. And so who or what is God to you?
Well, I find there's many ways to answer that. But I think one answer I would think is, like, God is somewhat of a big divine mystery to me, and I like that. I don't, you know, I don't need to logically try to figure God out. You know, I feel God's presence, and I feel God's nearness, and I feel the absolute desire of God to help me, and to, like I tell my kids, you know, he wants what's good for you, right? And like, he's on your side, right. That kind of thing. And you know, like God is like walking us through life, you know? And I feel like I've been allowed to do this kind of work or play, and, you know, I can sing while I'm doing it.
Have you been a part of a church or a congregation?
I was raised and still attend the Christian Reformed Church.
Okay.
So, So it's all part of our story.
Yeah.
Yeah, our family story. Yeah.
Okay. So you know this is kind of a church plant project or something like that, the Wiki God project.
Sure. And
maybe just asking you before we sign off here, what do you think the church, so you've been part of a church, and I just love the way you describe God. So what do you think God people, church people, however you want to put that, should be doing in the world and for the world? What do you think God followers should be up to?
Yeah, I always think we should be kind of grabbing the world by the horns and grappling and in a way making it a better place. Like, you know, in some ways, I mean, there's all these different elements to quote unquote the world, you know, but definitely, I'm in the business of beauty, right? And so I'm thinking, definitely, us God people, we need to address beauty. I mean, God loves beauty. God is a creator, you know, of the desert flower, you know, that nobody sees. And we don't need to build our churches just tan and white. You know, we can put color and beauty and gorgeous architect in. We can. And I think as God's people, it's that's what we should be doing, you know.
Well, that's beautiful, and that should be the last word, I think.
Thank you.
So do you have any, just before we go, do you have any major kind of projects or developments that we can be looking out for coming up?
I'm just working.
Just working away?
I'm just working really hard. Yes.
Good.
So
good.
I'm, personally, I'm always looking at the next piece and excited. So,
Good. Well, that's great. Have I left anything out?
I don't think so.
Anything you wanted to get off your chest here? We're good. We've covered everything.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Alice. It's been great.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go. Alice Vandervannen. Now make sure you go check out everything she's up to and everything she's about, alicevandervannen.ca. Find out where her art is near you. And now, after you do that, make sure you subscribe to WikiGod on FaceStrong today so you never miss an uncut episode of WikiGod. And to connect with me, email me. Shoot me an email at mark@wikigodpod.com, P-O-D, or tweet me at Mark Grollo or at WikiGodPod on Twitter. I'd love to engage your thoughts and hear your feedback about anything you're hearing here. And join us again right here on Faith Strong today. Next week, we are Wikiing God with Dr. John Neufeld. That might be a name that's familiar to you. If you listen to Joy 1250, he was a minister for 30 years out in BC. And he has a show on Joy 1250 right around the time I appear on WikiGod. He is the Back to the Bible Canada's Bible teacher. So we get to know John better, WikiGod with John. So that's next week right here, faithstrongtoday.com, the full interview. You don't want to miss it. That's it for today. Thanks for wikiing, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to WikiGod, presented by Faith Strong Today. Share this episode on social media and find more great programs at faithstrongtoday.com.